morning. History is alive. I'm sure you probably have heard that saying before. We know that history has happened in the past, doesn't exist anymore. But there's still a lot of practical functions to history. We often learn from history, and we always hear the statement, history repeats itself. As an example, currently we're facing something that is repeating itself in history, and I want to give you an example up here. Can you throw that first slide up? Okay, not intending to get political, but history involves politics. So I just want to explain these two images to you guys. This one over here is from World War II era, late 1930s. And that is Churchill's face. That's why the octopus looks so ugly. And there's a Star of David over the octopus, and it's sucking the life out of the earth. This was anti-Semitic propaganda used in World War II that the Nazis used to make people think that the Jews were evil and they needed to be eradicated. And then if you look current day, you have this one over here, and you see the Star of David on this black octopus, and it's got its tentacles wrapped around the entire earth. And then you have Arabic writing down here. This is what ISIS is using as their anti-Semitic propaganda today. Looks very similar, doesn't it? And so this is a prime example of history repeating itself. And a lot of times we don't learn from the lessons that history teaches us, like the lessons we learned during the Second World War. And so we see history repeating itself. You can take this down now. I don't know what my next slide is, but yeah, thanks. So bad stuff can happen, obviously, if we don't look at the past, see those lessons that we learned, and continue to remember them. We're forgetting in our culture today about this anti-Semitic propaganda, so it's happening again. And it's actually working. There's all sorts of videos that show anti-Semitic attitude throughout the whole world, different nations. This morning, we're going to see how history influences particularly our Christian experience. Now, we could think that just generally history repeats itself, that generally history can change us. But if you think about it, as distinctly Christian people living in this world, history has lessons for our practical life with God. And we're going to learn about that today. Last week, Rob ended his sermon in that last section of chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, where Paul focuses on this intense self-control. And he warns of the dangers in this next section of not having that intense self-control. He explains these analogies of training and running a race to win the race. And you have to have intense self-control to accomplish those goals. This morning, in Paul's Jewish mindset, he's going to look at the Old Testament. And he's going to look particularly at the Exodus. This is the epitome of Israel's history, of seeing God's redemptive work in their history. The climax of that was the Exodus. He's going to take that and he's going to apply it to the Corinthian church. So just like that God would save Israel out of their slavery and restore them, Paul's frame of reference is going to point towards the church, where Paul is saving us and restoring us out of our slavery. And so he's going to use these historical events as a metaphor for something for his Corinthian Christians and for us. And this is a typical way that New Testament writers use the Old Testament. This is a typical way they understand the Old Testament, and this is a typical way they synthesize it. They take it as a metaphor and they apply it to us. So he's going to break his argument in this next section. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and we're going to look at the first 13 verses. These 13 verses, Paul breaks up into three major sections. The first one, Israel failed to obtain the prize and remain with God. They failed at what he just encouraged. Even though they had divine privileges like baptism, and food provision in the desert. They failed to remain with God. They failed to have self-control. In the second section, he will explain the reasons why they failed. And in the last section, he uses these examples that he has to directly address the Corinthians about their ability to also be prone to falling away, even though they don't feel the dangers. Okay? And in each of these sections, our points this morning, each section that I just told you about is going to have one explicit warning for the church in Corinth. I think these dangers serve for us as how Israel's history can inform us of dangers that we might encounter as Christians, so that we can exhibit and express and practice intense self-control. Now, I want to warn you before I give you the warnings that these can be very uncomfortable warnings. They're going to seem very pointed. I just want to encourage you before we jump into these three warnings to really examine your heart and think through the issues that Paul is going to bring up in this passage. It's very important for us to be real with ourselves and with God about where we're at with Him. And a lot of these things, they kind of shatter the masks that we wear, especially on Sunday mornings. So I just want to encourage you as we get into this to just really examine your heart as you think through this information. So let's start with the first warning. We're warned against being a fake Christian. We're warned against being a fake Christian. That's the first warning, and if you haven't turned there, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We're going to start in verse 1. It says this, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." So we see already the saturation of Old Testament stories into Paul's teaching here. So let's talk about this. To begin this section, the readers of Corinth, Jewish or Gentile, they need to understand these stories as their own ancestors. That's a very important thing to point out here. Paul assumes that the Corinthian church views Israel as their ancestors, as their fathers. And as he's using these Old Testament passages, he's teaching the church to look at and understand the Old Testament a certain way to help them in their current spiritual mindset. The cloud and the sea that we see, he's talking about the cloud and the sea. This is the Exodus of the Old Testament and the wandering in the desert. But they're representatives of something. It's a representation of the covenant belonging that Israel had with God. God's protection and provision were divine. And partaking of that meant you were a part of this covenant between God and Israel. And further, Paul mentions the spiritual food and spiritual drink that they're experiencing daily. They're drinking. This is physical, by the way, but it's coming from something miraculous. It didn't exist. God is giving it. That's why it's spiritual. So they're eating food, real food, that is provided by God alone, and they're drinking from a rock that's shooting out water. Paul sees that as spiritual because it's God providing it. But they still displeased God. Most of them, it says in verse 5. So why does this whole passage about the Exodus and Israel's disobedience, even though they were experiencing God's provision and protection in the sea and the cloud, how does this relate to the Corinthian church? Well, I think there's two ways you can understand this, these first five verses. The first one is the Corinthians are struggling with this hyper-sacramentalism, that they think they're safe just because they're partaking of the Lord's Supper, communion, and they're baptized. If they do those two things, they're Christians and nothing can stop them. Just maybe like the Israelites felt in the desert wandering. We're part of the covenant because of baptism with Moses and partaking of the food that God's miraculously provided for us. A second option is that Paul is describing an attitude of idolatry that the Corinthians have. And this is the main thing, because we know for a fact, in fact, Craig talked about it a few weeks ago, that the Corinthian church, for the most part, openly rejected idolatry. False gods were not a part of their thinking. They knew they were fake. But they feel that there's no real danger in idolatry that required protection because of the Lord's Supper and baptism, because they call themselves Christians. Either way, they're in danger of thinking that because they belong to this group of people, like the Israelites did in the Exodus, then they are spiritually safe. And so verse 4, if you go back, it gives us a picture of this warning more clearly. They drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. And God still was displeased in verse 5. Jewish tradition, this is interesting, Jewish tradition tells us that the rock actually followed them in the desert. The rock moved as the Israelites moved and provided water for them. So there's this really spiritual element to the water that they were getting throughout the desert wandering. But the bottom line is, however they were being provided for, it was divine. And Paul is reflecting on Deuteronomy 32, where the main name for God is rock. And so he's looking at that story and saying, that was Jesus that they experienced, even though they may not have known it yet. And that's incredible to think through. And it's important to note that not all of the Israelites that experienced this divine blessing pleased God. In fact, most of them did not. Not all had that outcome, but most did, of being in danger, of being fake. Paul gives more details later as to why they didn't please God, but it's because of this danger of being a fake Christian. It's the danger of Christian nominalism. The danger of nominalism is having no basis for what you say you are. There's no basis for these Israelites that displease God for being a part of the covenant community. They're taking from God and they're doing whatever they want. God has, his provision had no bearing on their lives outside of the fact that they were taking his spiritual food. So even though they experienced incredible redemptive work, they rebelled. And the Corinthians are facing the same danger. The Corinthians have a baseless identity as Christians. Just because of the Lord's Supper and because of baptism, they think they're safe. And so they're going, and Craig did tell us a couple weeks ago that there is a conscious thing, a line that you need to draw personally. But at the same time, the Corinthians are looking at food sacrificed to idols, and they're not just consuming it from the market or from the Thai restaurant in the back of the building, like Craig mentioned. They're openly saying, I know it's sacrificed to idols, and I don't care, I'm going to consume as much as I want, because I'm fine. And that's the danger of being fake. Because, you know, the Israelites, we're going to see this idea of taking God's provision and then abusing that privilege leads to idolatry and sexual immorality and grumbling and destruction. So the Corinthians are facing this danger, and Paul is warning them, don't be fake. Don't think that your identity is based on this quote-unquote Sunday morning experience. It's based on so much more than that. And if we point to that as our identity marker, we're in danger of being fake also. You know, our culture allows us to disassociate what we say we believe with how we act. It's really easy for us to come to church on Sunday mornings, to proclaim a Christian life. I'm a Christian because I sit in the pews on Sunday, but there is no bearing that Christ has on our lives outside of these walls. That's what the Israelites and then the Corinthians were struggling with. And it's the same thing we can struggle with. The question is, does your daily grind reflect the lessons you learned in here on Sunday mornings? What I mean by that is the lessons that God is teaching you, is it affecting how you see life Monday through Saturday? Does it have any bearing on how you live? It's important for us to stop and think about how these gatherings should affect that. How does this gathering affect the way you live your life? This isn't what makes you safe. This is what prepares you to be safe. But how practically can you guys do this? How can you go out, take these lessons, and say, I don't want to be a fake Christian, but I don't know really how to express that throughout the week? Well, one response is to interact with God throughout the week. Wake up 20 minutes early and read a passage that you've memorized or that impacts your daily life and pray through that passage. Matthew 22, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. God, how am I going to love you more today and love my neighbor better today? That's how Christ has bearing on our lives. When we allow what he is doing on this Sunday morning thing or in these Christian religious things, it has bearing on our lives. It plays out throughout the week. And we interact with the living God. Israel didn't do that. They said, yeah, we see the provision, we see the redemptive work, but we don't care. And the Corinthians are saying the same thing about food sacrificed to idols. We don't care. And some of you might answer the question, how can I love God more today and how can I love my neighbor more today? Very simply, I'm lazy at work. I need to work harder. That will honor you, Lord. Take in your neighbor's trash cans because they're a single mom. Works three jobs. There are lots of practical ways that our Christian identity should have a bearing on our daily lives outside of these walls. When we don't do that, when we don't allow God to influence our week, we're these fake Christians that just sit here and do exactly what Israel did. We see the redemptive work of God, maybe in other people, and nothing happens in our own hearts. The second warning. We are warned against being an unfaithful Christian. I told you a lot of these are hard. We are warned against being an unfaithful Christian. Look with me in verse 6. Now these things took place as an example for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. So he gives example after example after example here. Verse 6 serves as this transition for us to see, and it's going to be a lot like verse 11 when we get there. He's using language to refer to an example of patterns found in people and events. So these people and these events, these things happened as an example for us to be careful of something. Well, we see in the end of verse 6 what that is, that we might not desire evil as they did. And that's the key here, because the Corinthians have openly rejected idols. But constantly consuming idols without a care in the world, for Paul, leads to desiring evil. And I'm going to explain why from these stories. It's pretty clear. So the first one is from verse 7. Paul uses Exodus 32. He actually quotes Exodus 32:6 to inform the Corinthians of understanding the ethical and spiritual dangers that they're facing with their arrogant attitudes towards idol feasts, their disregard for idol feasts. I'm a Christian, so it doesn't matter. I can go. And the idolatry for Israel, the unfaithfulness for Israel, came when Israel chose to both disregard what God had provided for them and blatantly disregard God himself in willingly partaking of, eating, and drinking at these Moabite festivals of idol worship. And then it ended in committing sexual debauchery in celebrating these idols. What makes it worse is they were willing to accept God's gracious provision in the desert
just to look at God and say, I don't care, I'm going to go do that. That's the example in verse 7. But how is this an appropriate metaphor for the Corinthian church to be drawn into? He's drawing them into this history-shaped lesson for one specific reason. Even though they consciously reject idolatry, they behaviorally accept it as no big deal. So their behavior is reflecting an acceptance of it, and they're desiring meat sacrificed to idols slowly over time. And it's causing them to desire evil. Or they're coming up to the line at least, dipping their toes in the devil's bathtub. So as you remember, Craig talked about this as a gray area. Some people can go behind the Thai restaurant or behind the Buddhist temple and eat in the Thai restaurant. Some people probably shouldn't. Well, Paul here is making it more of a black and white area when it comes to our heart attitudes. And this tension is going to continue to carry through the end of this chapter. So that gray area that he talks about in chapter 8, it'll still be a gray area in the end of chapter 10, but here we see an explicit warning based on a heart attitude that people just do not care, which leads, for Paul, to unfaithfulness, desiring evil, committing idolatry. And we have numerous examples of how we can apply this culturally. I'll take one, alcohol. It's not expressly forbidden in Scripture. But there's a clear line on one can become idolatrous in the area of alcohol. It's when you say this, I can drink alcohol, okay statement. Moving towards, I have the freedom and I have I deserve to drink alcohol. My freedom gives me the ability to do it, and I deserve that. It's going from having the ability to do it and your freedom to saying you deserve to do it because of your freedom. That's when it starts to become idolatrous. That's when that gray area starts to become black and white. Because then you're not being sensitive to people around you. You disregard every other person because of it. So that's when it leads to unfaithfulness to God or idolatry. Is when you prop it up as something you deserve. The next example of Israel's history is in verse 8. Numbers 25, 1 through 9 is what Paul is drawing on. And in that passage, the Israelites were committing gross sexual immoral acts with the Moabite women. So what was happening was they were engaging in inappropriate behavior with Moabite women. But then these women would invite them to these feasts. And the Israelites, knowing God's provision, knowing God's redemptive work, would go to these feasts, knowing that they were idol feasts, and they would eat the meat anyway, and then that would lead to them bowing down to the idols. And it's a slippery slope that you just come crashing down. And he's warning the Corinthians here, we must not become sexually immoral like they did, because they were destroyed. So this engaging in this haphazard behavior, this reckless behavior, led to idolatry and destruction. And it makes sense. This one actually makes sense for the Corinthians, right? Because it's something they're struggling with. Sexual immorality is pervasively worse in the church, in the Corinthians, than most other churches. He's saying that this leads to unfaithfulness to God. And if the Corinthians don't heed this warning, they will be unfaithful also. They will be committing idolatry. In verse 9, Paul is drawing on Numbers 21, 5 and 6. The Old Testament text refers to when the Israelites were wandering and complaining that they didn't have enough food and water. So they spoke against God and they criticized him in their complaints. And they gave their loyalty to someone else. And they desired loyalty to something else. Psalm 78:18 gives a really good example of what was going on in the hearts of the Israelites. It says this, they tested God in their hearts by demanding the food that they craved. They didn't want God's food. They wanted other food, which was being sacrificed to idols in these other villages. They insisted on the food they craved and desired, even at the expense of provoking God. And so if the Corinthians insist on persistently consuming food associated to idols, they're in danger of this unfaithfulness. And then finally, there's verse 10, which is the last example of grumbling. And this, they were destroyed by the destroyer. This is just an allusion to lots of Old Testament texts, kind of like the imagery put into one little phrase here. There are so many passages about Israel grumbling. And there are several passages about the destroyer, the angel of death, destroying. But Israel grumbled against Moses, which means they grumbled against God. And the same for the Corinthian church. We know from chapter 1, who are the Corinthians grumbling against? Paul. And so therefore, they're grumbling against God. It's a reflection of their dissatisfaction with God, which leads to unfaithfulness. So Paul is warning them, don't grumble like the Israelites did, or it will lead to unfaithfulness. So we can have a similar danger with us, but probably what I was thinking when I read this text was, I don't really eat food sacrificed to idols. Craig brought the same issue up culturally. So I don't know, like I have no bearing on what, how do I apply this to me personally? Well, you have to understand first that this is a heart issue that Paul is talking about. When he's warning the Corinthians, he's warning them against an issue of the heart. And unfaithfulness is a heart issue that can take many forms in our lives. Imagine a dude named John. John is faithful to attend church. He actually encourages children to participate in church. He even has spiritual conversations with his family. But he has an unhealthy craving for work. I don't mean he works hard to provide for his family. That's different. I'm talking about a man who has an unhealthy craving. No matter what, if work calls, he's going to go put that over everything else in his life. Even his kids, church, it doesn't matter. Because of a heart issue, John is unfaithful to God. And we could replace that with anything in our lives. An emotional affair you might have with somebody who's not your spouse. When you're being unfaithful like that, you're being unfaithful to God. Could be laziness when it comes to school or working at home with your family. Maybe it's ignoring your need to invest your relationship to God through more intentional time of prayer and worship on your own because you're too busy. Busyness can be a root of unfaithfulness. Maybe it's ignoring your conscience when you really want to go see that movie that you know is going to cause you to struggle spiritually, but it's only a 5-minute scene, so it's cool. You're compromising for that 5-minute scene. And you're being unfaithful to God. And this list can continue on and on and on. And there are several things in my life that I thought about when I was reading this that really challenged me. But how do we heed this warning against being unfaithful? I'm going to practice something with you guys this morning. It's going to take just a few minutes. And so I want you to just kind of look up at the screen. I'm going to put this passage up. One way to really practice fighting these warnings, these dangers in our lives, and unfaithfulness is one. There's a passage up here, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him and He will make your paths straight, or make straight your paths. A lot of times our unfaithfulness comes from us saying, God, I don't trust You to take care of me in my life, so I'm just going to take care of it myself. Well, one way for you to fight this danger is to be reminded of the truth daily. So I want you to look at this proverb right now. Just clear your mind, look at this proverb, think about it, and take a moment to think about all the things in your heart. You don't have to say anything, just in your heart, all the things that you prioritize over God, over your relationship with God. What are those things? So just think through those things right now. Take a minute to do that. Now I want you to take a minute. I want you to prayerfully read through this passage again. Read through it differently this time. As you read through it, pray these words to God, keeping in mind those things you prioritize over God, and lay them at his feet as you're prayerfully thinking through this passage. Take a minute to do that. I hope for you that this is a reminder to trust in God with all of your being, to acknowledge his work in your life, his gracious, his distinctly gracious work. When you continue to trust in him, he will make your path straight. We don't have to worry about unfaithfulness to God when he's making our path straight. And these are the types of things that I think you can do in the face of the danger of unfaithfulness to God. When you're facing idolatry because of a priority you have, remember passages like this. Stop and pray through it. And think about and remind yourself of the truth. Last warning. We are warned against being arrogant Christians. This is the danger of spiritual elitism. We're warned against being arrogant Christians. Look with me at verse 11. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the ends of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. So again, like I said, verse 11 has similar language to verse 6 where Paul says, these happened as an example for our instruction, on whom the ends of the age has come. That's an interesting phrase I want to remind you of. For Paul, as in his Jewish mindset, he looked at the quote-unquote eschatological people as the final people of God. Guess who he thought that was? It's the church. It's us. It's the grafted in Gentiles into the Jewish nation that represents the church. We are the last people. And so Paul looks at Israel's history, Jewish history, Old Testament history, as instructions for us. So as God's redemptive plan is playing out in human history, we need to look back at God's example, that at God's people and everything that they went through as instructions for how we should live our lives. So for Paul, the entire Old Testament, the stories, the promises, the prophecies, they were written down specifically for the eternal purposes of God to be revealed as instructions for us. That's incredible. And so why a warning against being an arrogant Christian? Well, in verse 12, Paul's language suggests that the Corinthians believed that they were impenetrable spiritually because of their knowledge and experience. Paul's warning, be careful, if you think you stand, that you do not fall. And we know for certain in earlier passages that this was a true reality for the church. They thought that they were spiritually elite. They were arrogant Christians. But just like the Israelites who fell into the same trap and ultimately committed heinous acts against God, so too will the Corinthians fall, and I think we will fall. And so Paul ends his history lesson pointing out the incredible faithfulness of God. God is faithful. First, like the examples, the Corinthians are facing temptation that's unique. It's not unique. In fact, rabbinic texts revealed to us that the two most common sins that people, that humans struggled with, were sexual immorality and idolatry. They were the most common things that people struggled with. And it was true of this church. But notice that Paul also uses the phrases like some of them in um, in verse 12. Therefore, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not tempt you beyond your ability. I skipped it, I think. It's in verse 10, I think. Sorry, we won't go back. But Paul uses this phrase that some of them did not face these temptations. And that's because they focused on the faithfulness of God. Most of them fell. Some of them did not. Why is that? Because the character and nature of God was revealed and trusted in by these people. God is faithful in two ways. He won't tempt you beyond your ability, and he gives you a way out. And this should bring incredible comfort to our lives. God and his faithfulness to you will give you the resources to endure, to have that intense self-control that Paul talks about in the end of chapter 9. One of my favorite pastors, I listen to his sermons all the time, John Piper, says this about verse 13. God will never give his people trials in which he will not sustain them and bring them through to everlasting glory. We will be enabled to do all we must to get there. So when we look at verse 13 and we see that incredible gift of God's faithfulness to us, we know that he will give us everything we need to endure to the end, to glory. And it's because of his faithfulness that we endure, not because of anything inside of us. So when we face this danger of being an arrogant Christian, we need to realize it's not because of yourself or your unique qualities that make you a good, awesome Christian. It's because of God's faithfulness that you can be faithful to him. He's given you the ability to endure. He's given you the ability to succeed. It reminds me of passages like Philippians 1:6, where Paul says, I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. And so I want to talk to those of you that might honestly admit that you're struggling with spiritual elitism. I don't know who that is. Typically, we don't go around bragging about being arrogant. But I want you to think about the faithfulness of God from chapter 10, verse 13, and this passage that God is doing a work in you. Understand, yeah, you're awesome. If you're struggling with that arrogance, you are awesome. But it's because God has made you awesome. God has made you an incredible person. God has uniquely gifted you for our fellowship. You don't need to have that spiritual elitism to prove yourself or for any reason. We're all on different paths, and I know if you think about this, that God's the one that's working in you. And that's incredible. And I honestly need that, personally, to grow as a Christian myself. So if this is something you're struggling with, my encouragement for you is to go home and to make it a prayer that you are going to allow the gifts that God has given you to shine through. And you're just going to let that happen naturally. Because it will. And when you are feeling the urge of temptation, remember God is faithful. And we all struggle with this. Every single human has temptation. We need to understand that it's God's faithfulness that brings us through. I would encourage you, if you're in a boat where temptation seems to be overwhelming, take chapter 10, verse 13, write it down on a note card. Memorize it. Commit that verse to memory. Remind yourself daily of the truth of who God is as you face temptation each day. So in this passage, Paul focuses on the dangers all believers face in daily life. This is daily. We face the being fake, unfaithful, or arrogant. The Israelites struggled with this stuff, the Corinthians did, and so do we. But the incredible conclusion that God's faithfulness helps us in the midst of these dangers is a comfort. So let's face these three dangers together, building each other up instead of tearing each other down. Let me pray. God, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for